Hey, Kelsey.
Hey, Brooke.
Want to tell everyone what's happening in today's episode?
In today's episode, we are back with the first ladies' man. Dun, 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 dun.
Oh my gosh, all I think about is that SNL skit. Awesome.
Yeah, he's amazing, and I can't wait to get into it.
Let's go.
Hello, and welcome to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%. The podcast that explores what happened to the women in history class. Now, here's your host, Kelsey Brooke Eckert, and her partner in crime, Brooke Neva Sullivan.
So, Brooke, we are back with the first ladies' man today to talk about Rosalind Carter.
Okay.
Yeah, she just passed away last month, and obviously
that's... I watched her service. It was really beautiful.
Yeah, and he was there.
What?
What? I know. So I was really excited. We've had him on the podcast before, and I'm really excited to have him back to tell us more. He knows the Carters family and just has a lot of like personal connections to share with us, as well as obviously, you know, telling us a little bit about her legacy, because first ladies don't get recognized enough.
And you're first lady, so president's wives.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool.
But before we get into that, let's do a little business update.
Business update. Sorry.
It's giving season right now, and the Remedial Hershey Project just won a big grant from the Anna Lee Foundation. Anna Lee makes dolls. They're actually from Meredith, New Hampshire.
I know. They're very cool little dolls. If you've ever seen them, they're collectibles.
Yep.
But they do a lot of good work in the community, and they gave us an awesome grant,
yeah,
which is so nice of them.
They're so awesome. And so it's helping us, you know, inch closer and closer towards our goals for the 24 fiscal year. But
we have some big operational goals. And so that's some of the stuff behind the scenes that listeners may not always get to see. But we have an army of incredible people that donate their time and energy to writing lesson plans and doing all the great work that we do for teachers and getting stuff out there and going to events. And it takes money to do those things. And people donate so much of that to us, which is incredible. But grants that we get are awesome. And this, for those who don't know, is a big season when most charities get a lot of their funding. And so you're probably thinking about, where can I donate money, or how can I contribute and make sure that I'm giving back to the charities that really matter to me? And RHP is so thankful for those who do spend their money with us, and it's really nice of them.
Yeah. So you can go to remedialherstory.com/giving, and all the ways to give are there. And if you're old school, you can send a check in the mail. We take those.
We love
too.
Those checkies. We love those paper checks.
P.O. Box 412 in Plymouth, New Hampshire.
Yeah. And it goes to the great work that we're doing and the big goals that we have for next year and how much we can impact and give back to teachers, which is the goal. We want to get stuff to teachers.
And at the beginning of the month, I had an amazing opportunity to go to the National Council for Social Studies conference in Nashville.
Oh my gosh, so fun. It looked amazing.
Yeah, we had a booth there and it was wildly popular. We added like hundreds of people to our
newsletter. I loved watching the comments feed on Instagram, like how many people are interacting and like new followers and people visiting the website. And like, I have the Venmo account on my phone, so when people purchase stuff from the store, I see it come through. I'm like, yes, like this is awesome. It was so fun just to not be there with you, but be like feeling the energy all the way here in New Hampshire. So but tell me some more. So how was the event?
We sold out all the t-shirts that we bought.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. Like,
that was really cool. So
and you spoke, right? You had
We had a actually, this is an even cooler story. So Sarah, who is our coordinator of professional development, and I had a poster session, and I lost my voice at the beginning of the month, which is part of why we haven't had any episodes recently. And
that, and also the plague has been in my house as well. So Kelsey and I have been trying to keep our distance.
Yep.
So we do record in person.
Yes. And so Sarah and I had a poster session scheduled and for the Library of Congress Teaching with Primary Sources grant. And I didn't have a voice. And so my student, Lauren, who has long time been a
phenomenal resource.
She is our webmaster now. She's an outstanding future middle school teacher. I just like can't wait for her students. But anyway, Lauren was like, I'll do it. And so she went and she delivered the poster session for me, which was amazing. Because I literally couldn't speak.
Were you like
the whole conference?
Tears.
It was beautiful.
This is such a moment where like your little baby bird is out in the universe doing the good stuff.
Yeah, she was awesome.
Oh, we're so lucky that you have these incredible students that spend their time. But when you meet them and they just are lighting the world on fire, I'm like, oh my God, we're not all dying. This is so good.
So that was a really special moment. And then the other really big special moment for me was this guy who is the department head in the Louisville School District stopped by. And this is a school district that services like over 100,000 kids.
So for those who don't know, I have family in Louisville, but so I know because of that, biggest school district in the country.
Yeah, huge.
Louisville is, and it's also some of the most competitive magnet schools that are feeder programs to the Ivies in the country as well. So it's a very competitive, highly educated environment.
Yeah. And
some people would think that like Washington or Boston would have that.
Yeah.
It's Louisville.
It was interesting when people stopped by our booth, like it was usually the women that came over. They were like, oh, like, da, da, and they'd be walking with their male colleagues, right?
Shocker.
And it was interesting, like the male colleague reaction to our booth, because like this is just as much for male teachers as it is for female teachers, right?
Wait, say that louder.
No, for the people in the back. And you know, there were some guys who would stop in and be like, you know, like, oh, I'm not, you know, they just kind of like walk away. And there was this one woman who like bought a t-shirt and her male colleague standing right next to her. And we were like, do you want one too? And he's like, I don't think I can wear. And it's like a blue t-shirt that says Herstory is half of history. Like there's nothing
controversial
girly about it, you know, or something. But anyway.
Repel. Is that a vagina? Run.
So whenever.
Did you just say pregnancy? Ovaries? Ugh.
Body parts. So anyway, this, you know, when we had guys who like really engaged with us, it was just like, thank you for existing and like being the awesome person.
Yeah, that
you
are. We have like so many male listeners to the podcast and who donate time and energy and resources. So it's like, no, we have a lot of guys hanging out in this crowd. Like, more are welcome. Get in here.
So the department head of this major school district stops by and we show him the site. We walk him through, you know, here's how you get the article, the free textbook online.
Yeah.
Here's the lesson plans. Here's the primary sources. One of my students, Luke, went through and added feature films. His internship this fall was like scrolling IMDb to find films about women and add them to every single unit on the website. And, you know, this
superintendent
guy is like, I'm sold. And I want this in every classroom in our district. And I was just like,
that's amazing.
So you get one person to stop at the booth. And if we have hundreds of people stopping at the booth, buying t-shirts, getting excited, like those are the teachers. And think about how many students those teachers impact.
Yeah.
You know,
I always think of the metaphor of the ripple effect that you have on the universe and the people around you. And I just love that you chose to go to this event because it's obviously super rewarding and we get a lot out of it. And it's really fun to promote the organization there. But then it doesn't matter how many people you meet. It's just one can exponentially change the education and the curriculum for so many women.
Yeah.
And that's the cool stuff about the work we're doing. It's like, oh, just meeting one. And he's like, let's sold. Do this. Sold. Let's get this into every classroom.
Yep.
Let's make sure teachers are certified.
Yep.
Let's make sure that we have equitable education. It's like, hallelujah.
Yeah.
It's
like, so if you have the opportunity to give your money, you can go to remedialherstory.com/giving and support this work. You can also reach out to us using our contact on the website and
Instagram. You can donate right from your Facebook page, from your Instagram page. There's lots of ways to give if you want to give.
And you can also give in kind, right? If you're like, I don't have that ability, like send us a book, send us an article, send us modify lesson plans for us for middle schools.
Like, how about recently? Like I had a coworker that was like, I love the work you're doing. I have a friend that does SEO work. Do you think you need someone? I'm like, yeah.
Like, take it.
Would love an SEO person. And she's like, oh yeah, I also have this person that does graphic design. It's like, send them my way. Sounds like a great person I should know. So it's also about the people you network with and the people you know that really could help propel RHP forward, because we're coming into almost 5 years and it's like, damn.
Yeah. So speaking of men that are awesome and support our work, let's turn this back to the first ladies man
who's
going to talk to us about a really important woman, Rosalynn Carter, and let's have him introduce himself.
Sure. My name is Andrew Oak, and I'm the first ladies man. I'm the first ladies man because I had the good fortune and honor and privilege of being a series producer for C-SPAN and the White House Historical Association's television series, First Ladies, Influence and Image. And that series ran from President's Day 2013 to President's Day 2014 and covered every first lady and hostess, nearly every hostess. There's a lot of them kind of speckled in there in some of the more interesting administrations as far as first ladies or lack thereof are concerned. But for all intents and purposes, every first lady and significant hostess, from Martha Washington to Michelle Obama. That series is available online. You can go to firstladiesman.com and go to the video page and click the C-SPAN link at the top. And that whole series, beginning, middle, end, and even extras, is free and online. All of that at firstladiesman.com. And I could not be more grateful to C-SPAN and the White House Historical Association for giving me the opportunity, but also having the trust in me to go out in the field to travel to every library, church, home, school, train station, in Mrs. Carter's case. We'll get to that in a little bit. But basically every location that had anything to do with every first lady. Since the series, I have continued my studies. I've written two books. And I do a speaking series and online availability of all kinds of resources for every first lady up until including, you know, Dr. Jill Biden, who I think is just fantastic and somehow even more than me manages to be in more than one place at the same time. She's remarkable on a lot of different levels.
Is not your first time on our podcast. This is your third episode. I feel like we need to do SNL where you get a jacket and it, you know.
Sure. Well, I think they get the jacket at five. So we've got two more to do before you need to run out and buy a 44 regular. It would be fantastic. whatever sport coat you decide on. I think the last time we talked about Eleanor Roosevelt, and probably the first time, was just an overview for folks who haven't seen that or can find the archive of that or what have you. But we did drill down on Eleanor Roosevelt for obvious and incredible reasons there for her. And, you know, Rosalynn Carter took a lot of pages from Eleanor Roosevelt's playbook for the things that she did in office. And more importantly, post White House, because Rosalynn Carter has had one of, if, well, you know, I never speak in absolutes, and there's an absolute. I rarely speak in absolutes. But when I think of prolific post White House careers for first ladies, I think of Eleanor Roosevelt, Betty Ford, Barbara Bush, and Rosalynn Carter. You can also still going and still contributing and still having very, very active post White House lives would be Laura Bush and Michelle Obama. Yeah. So I know that they will be in that category one day too, the longer they are not in the White House and continue those careers. But
so a little bit about, because when I think of the Carters, I think of both of them as really substantial after their president, they're after they're in the White House. What is significant about her during, you know, they have a 1 year term or one term presidency where they're in office in the late 70s. What's significant about Rosalynn Carter's contributions then?
Well, you make an excellent point, and they both are. I mean, of course, President Carter, wildly accomplished, including one of his most recent accomplishments, staying alive for his wife 99 years old. He's been in hospice for 10 months. And President Carter expressed great concern when he went into hospice. He told friends and family, and that's how I get the information through family members, that he was worried that he was going to go before Mrs. Carter did. And this would not have been a concern had she not had dementia, but he felt the duty and the need to make sure that she died as peacefully and as clear a mind as she could, given her disease. And he did it. And then for him to come out and attend the memorial services, both at home in Plains, Georgia, at Maranatha Baptist Church, and at the church there on Emory University, and even to have the wherewithal at 99 years old in his condition, 10 months in hospice, to say, I don't like my current black suit. I need a new suit. You know, had a new suit made. And you can't separate these two. It's very, very hard. During my studies and my travels for every first lady, I would walk into a place and very intentionally say, I don't want to hear about the president. I want to hear about I don't want to hear what Abe Lincoln did in this house or what Abe did with Mary. I want to hear what Mary did in this house. I want to hear what you know, Rosalind did at this, you know, corner store, you know, or whatever. And in Plains, you know, President Carter's mother, Miss Lillian, was in the delivery room. She was a delivery room nurse when Rosalind Carter was born. She was also the hospice nurse when Mrs. Carter's father passed away when she was 14 years old. After her father passed away when she was 14, she would have Rosalind Smith at the time. She was taken by President Jimmy Carter's mother out to the family peanut farm to be with her friends, which were President Carter's sisters at the time. So there really is no separating. They went to the same school. They lived in the same town. The Plains is only like 600 people today. I can't imagine what it was in the 20s and 30s. But your question is what she did in the White House to separate herself. She did something that some of the other first ladies that I've mentioned did, is she did something unusual. She focused in on a topic that was not popular. That wasn't something that was openly spoken about, and that's mental health. And a lot of people throughout these proceedings over the past few weeks and memorial services and TV interviews, and you don't always get the chance on TV, so I'm happy to have the chance now. I literally want to read what she did and the organizations that she was a part of. And this is why it's important, and this is why I can't remember all this and need to read it. To say that she was an advocate for mental health is great. Mental health is something that is still plaguing us. It's a huge problem, not only in America, around the world with human beings. But it's like Betty Ford's addiction or Betty Ford's breast cancer. People didn't even say the word breast on TV during newscasts in the 70s when Mrs. Ford announced that she had breast cancer. I had a woman come up to me and tell me at a speech that I gave. She said, I remember my father hearing on the nightly news at the dinner table that the First Lady had breast cancer. She said he spit his drink out and said, I can't believe they just said that on TV. I mean, this is where we were as a mind state in this. So there would be no pink ribbons and there would be no 5Ks and 10Ks and awareness and all the other stuff about breast cancer if it wasn't for Betty Ford. And we didn't invent breast cancer, obviously. The Adamses, one of the Adamses, President John Adams and Abigail Adams, one of their daughters had a mastectomy in the 1800s. I can't even imagine. And then to think that in the 1970s, in any event, I digress. But mental illness is another topic that was put in closets, swept under rugs, not talked about. That person just isn't right. We put them in a place for them, and that's where they'll be. And you know, there were stigmas associated with suicide that Mrs. Carter helped alleviate and say, you know, these people are not freaks. They're people that need help. There are people that in many cases can be helped, can be cured, so to speak, or medications can be given. And none of that attention or none of that work would we have been doing without. But not only did Mrs. Carter just say, you know, a lot of first ladies will go out and say, I'm against this, or I'm for this, or we got to, you know, raise money for this and do that. And, you know, that's well and good and fine. But then they go on to other things and other days. Mrs. Carter, right up until, I mean, still in the Carter Center and these foundations and things, her work will continue. But these are just some of the things that Mrs. Carter was directly associated with. The Carter Center Mental Health Task Force, that was promoting positive change and erasing stigmas. The Psychiatric Association, she was an honorary fellow for the American Psychiatric Association. The National Mental Health Association, the Rosalind Carter Annual Symposium on Mental Health Policy. The Women Leaders for Mental Health, the Rosalind Carter Fellowship for Mental Health Journalism. And she was part of a driving force that got the Mental Health and Addiction Equality Act of 2008 passed. I mean, it just went on and on. And that's just mental health. Another thing that's associated with the Carters, and this would have started while in the White House, but more extending to her post-White House career, was Habitat for Humanity. The Carters are almost synonymous with Habitat for Humanity, so much so that people think Habitat for Humanity is the Carters philanthropy or the Carters Foundation. And it's not. They're just regular people that picked up a tool belt, a hammer, a hard hat, and went and started building houses for people that didn't have them, or improving houses for people that had their houses destroyed in natural disasters or any other means of destruction. And I remember the Carters coming at each of them coming out of various health situations or hospital situations and not looking their best or feeling their best, but still working well into their 70s, 80s, and maybe even 90s. I don't know when the last time they swung a hammer was, but they were out there doing it. And there's great pictures of them together where she's even just kind of like holding the board and he's nailing it in, and they're both, it just, they just worked so well together. But she also worked very closely in Atlanta, where the Carter Center was, with unemployment and with women's causes and equal rights and ERA. She traveled around the world. She helped eradicate the guinea worm, which was killing people in Africa. And there really, you know, when it comes to Rosalind Carter, and this would have been in the White House, but again, largely outside of the White House, and her legacy and her continuing legacy, she was always learning, always wanting to get more information about the world around her. She learned that the monarch butterflies were having trouble migrating and pollinating and doing their part for the world and the ecology and all of the plants and flowers and everything. They were having trouble migrating from Mexico to Canada. So she put a butterfly trail in Plains, Georgia. And then she extended that butterfly trail across Georgia. Then she extended it from Mexico to Canada. So these monarch butterflies would have a trail. Then I just learned, during her memorial service at Emory, her assistant, her name is Catherine something with a C, Catherine Cade was Mrs. Carter's long-term assistant. She said that when Mrs. Obama was in the White House, Rosalind Carter called her and said, the White House is in line with this butterfly trail and we need to have a monarch butterfly, a butterfly garden there in the White House. And Mrs. Obama said yes, and put a butterfly garden there in the White House to help this migration. And this is kind of how I come to know the Carters. I was there for Mrs. Carter's birthday last year in 2022 in Plains. We were dedicating a sculpture in the Rosalind Smith Carter Childhood Garden. It's the garden that's right next to the house that she grew up in, the house that I mentioned prior, that her father died in, and President Carter's mother would have been the hospice nurse there in Plains, right around the corner of Main Street. Plains isn't a big place. It's easy to navigate, as you would imagine. But that garden is there. A friend of mine, Peter Hazel, made the sculpture. It's got 18 illuminated butterflies in these heart sweeping vines. It's absolutely beautiful. 18 butterflies for the 18th of August, Mrs. Carter's birthday. And we were all assembled there in the garden for an early morning breakfast and ceremony to physically release hundreds of butterflies into the garden there. And some of them have come back. Mrs. Carter's niece, Kim Fuller, has been posting pictures of the monarch butterflies as they come through, and two have recently come through a little late in the season for them as it got colder, but a nice tribute there to Mrs. Carter. We like to think that they're visiting for Mrs. Carter, but this is all part of being close to the family and knowing, grandchildren and cousins and Mrs. Carter's sister, Alethea. And of course, my continued thoughts and condolences go out to the family as they continue to navigate this first set of holidays, having just lost Mrs. Carter.
So what I'm hearing is that in her time in the White House, she literally saved lives, and then she continued that work all the way to present. It seems to me like the White House was a launching pad then for this extra, this work, this service work that she's doing for the environment, for women, for the world, for, you know, curing things. Was she doing this sort of work before she was in the White House, or did that platform sort of give her opportunity that she hadn't previously had?
Great question. So they were married very young. President Carter was still in the Navy, and they left planes. And after the Navy, Mr. Carter, soon to be President Carter, he wanted to go back to planes and get involved with the family peanut farm. And Mrs. Carter didn't want to go back. You know, I mean, you can imagine this, you know, small town girl finally gets out and sees the world and is like, wait, we're going backwards. We're going back to that tiny little town in this. But he convinced her, or they came up with a decision, you know, together. They realized it. They didn't do much without each other. You know, they would have definitely, you know, even if it wasn't her number one pick or choice, she would have had to come to terms with it to some level. She didn't do anything she didn't want to do. And they came to these decisions together, but they came back to planes. And then they launched a political career. You know, they saw a need to come back to the family and the family peanut farm and help out with that and help with the success of that and keep things going there and chugging along and having their home base. And in the early 60s, I think it was like 1961, they bought a chunk of land there and made the house that they still live in today. It's on the grounds there that Mrs. Carter is buried, and President Carter, and one day will follow her to that memorial. But then he ran for governor. And it's there that launches, and I think where they see this ability to help other people. And Mrs. Carter stepped right up and started learning everything she could about issues and politics and campaigning. And she started the Peanut Brigade, which was the grassroots door-to-door campaign effort to get President Carter elected into any of his positions. It got him elected governor. And then with that success of his governorship, she went to the national level. But it was while she was the first lady of Georgia that she started most of this work. So, you know, the coming back to Plains was a settling back in to the next stage post-military life. Post-military was political. She settled into that in the role of the president of the wife of the governor, and took on the mental health issue very, very early in her political career. So that followed her to the White House. And another aspect of that she focused on that people weren't focusing on at the time and still have trouble focusing on is the caregivers. Not only the people that have the issue, that have the problem, that need the help, that need the cure, but the people that are helping them, help shepherding them through, and doctoring them through, and advising, and the psychiatric aspects of the treatment and things. Those caregivers, which was an unusual perspective, she really wrapped her arms all the way around an issue and didn't stop until there were answers or solutions or progress moving forward, and understood that once a little bit of progress was made, the job was not done. This is ongoing. This will be forever. We will always need to improve upon these treatments and these conditions.
So how was it when you were at Emory in the last few weeks celebrating her life? What was it like being in that space? And you shared with me before we started recording that this was a really personal experience for you, because unlike some of the other first ladies you've studied, you knew family, and you were there. And I'm just curious what that experience has been like.
Certainly. Well, you know, I mean, the last time we saw the Carters was in September. September is just a couple months ago. President Carter had been in hospice for 9 months. Mrs. Carter had openly disclosed her dementia through the Carter Center. But there they are in a van, traveling through planes, waving to their friends, waving to their family, waving to the community in the Peanut Festival parade in September of 2023. And it's not, you know, 2 months later that she's gone. And the Carters were never forced to do anything. The Carters, you know, even when we were there prepping for the birthday celebrations and putting the statue together, apparently Mrs. Carter wanted to go for a drive and told her security detail and her assistants, hey, drive me around the town, you know, want to get some fresh air or something like that. And she saw stuff going on and she called Kim and Leanne and her nieces were just like, something's going on over at the house and you guys aren't telling me about it. We better know what's going to, like, no, it was going to be a surprise for your birthday. You're coming to, and darn if they weren't there for the birthday celebrations when I was able to present Mrs. Carter with a signed set of my books, which was just, I mean, surreal, and have a lovely little conversation there with her before she took her walker and went over to the statue to light it up for the first time. And even after she lit it up with the help of her sister Alethea, she turned and walked back. And I was just trying to stay out of the way, but I was in sort of her path of where she walked back and forth, standing off to the side. And she came over to me and she grabbed my hand again and she held it so tightly. And it was just, you know, it was just a wonderful, wonderful moment. And she said, thank you for being here. I said, no, Mrs. Carter, thank you for having me. Thank you for your work. Thank you for this beautiful statue and this opportunity in this park. It's just a wonderful tribute to a wonderful life. And she smiled and said, thank you and God bless. And she moved on to meet and speak with other people. But it was a very personal and very wonderful moment. So when I look at these proceedings going on, when I see these people talking, you know, it is personal.
So what at the ceremony did Rosalind Carter plan?
I would say Mrs. Carter planned just about everything except what the people actually said. The list of speakers was very specific. The events were very specific. Let's take it from the beginning. There is a funeral procession, a motorcade. People are told about the motorcade. They're invited to line the motorcade and wave and give their, put up their signs and their American flags as she would go to her former college, Georgia Southwestern in Americus, and the medical center there where she had done so much work for people and mental health and everything, and a wreath laying. You would saw the family come out and go in. I'm sure there were prayers and something said inside, you know, something that wasn't open to the public, and then to come back in and travel to Atlanta. About a 2.5 hour motorcade, again, published to the public so they could watch this and say their farewells as go along. She laid in state at the Carter Center, a place that she started. I mean, that's what many of these first ladies do, but you know, there would be no Carter Center without Rosalind Carter. And it was a place where she could continue her work. President Carter could continue his work in addition to archiving their past work and having the library and the museum and that aspect of the Carter Center. But it was a very, very active and forward-thinking institution to move the needle forward on all these events that they are, all these causes and philanthropies and issues that near and dear to the Carter's heart and their work. She laid in state there, a closed casket, but people could come by, again, open to the public from like 6 to 10 or something like that. Ridiculous long hours where people could come in and go. Then they motorcaded to Emory University, where they had the, you know, official public ceremony. All living first ladies in attendance. This is huge because these first ladies don't get together all that often. Not all. It was remarkable to see Melania Trump, Michelle Obama, Laura Bush, Hillary Clinton, then of course President Clinton, then Dr. Jill Biden, and President Biden. Of course, President and Jill Biden, very close with the Carters, as was President Clinton. I'm not sure why President Bush and President Obama were not present, especially Obama was tight with President Carter and Mrs. Carter, as was, you know, President Bush. But their wives were there and their wives were representing. And I'm sure they were, you know, had their reasons. And Donald Trump, you know, a lot of people were like, well, President Trump wasn't there. And that's for obvious reasons, because, you know, political. Okay, but Melania was. And Melania was there because Mrs. Carter invited her. Right. Then there was a big to-do about Melania not wearing black. That's okay. She wasn't wearing international orange. She wasn't wearing a swimsuit. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, like she was wearing a very appropriate gray patterned coat dress. I thought Jill best dressed at the funeral was Michelle Obama. I thought her outfit was dynamite. It was it was fantastic. Melania Trump got a lot of grief. Well, a funeral directors association or something was consulted, and gray, dark blue, and I've been looking at past first ladies ceremonies. You know, navy blue was worn by Hillary Clinton, who was first lady at the time when Mrs. Ford died. Nancy Reagan wore white and black to that funeral. Mrs. Carter wore gray to Mrs. Nixon's funeral. You know, any kind of white, gray, black, blue sort of combination is perfectly acceptable and not disrespectful at all. And I thought she looked lovely. I thought Mrs. Obama looked fantastic. Laura Bush always looks appropriate. Hillary Clinton was in her typical, what you would expect, the Nehru jacket kind of pantsuit, very complimenting and flattering. And I thought every first lady just looked and reacted well, laughed at the right times, clapped at the right times, all the other stuff. And I thought the first ladies represented their unique sorority of women very, very wonderfully. And I was not surprised by any of it. But, you know, the two surprises there at the funeral are Melania Trump, because she's been basically behind closed doors since they left the White House, and President Carter. Again, can't overstate the fortitude and the love that he would have had to make that happen, to make that 2.5-hour journey in his condition, you know, to make sure that he got to say goodbye to his wife. But you know, Garth Brooks and Trisha Yearwood performing Imagine, I'm sure that was no accident. You know, Garth and Trisha have a longstanding relationship with the president. They gave them a convertible Ford, a 1946 Ford, that the Carters would travel in parades. That's the year that they were born. And that was a gift from Garth Brooks and Trisha Yearwood. Chip thanked his grandmother, his mother, Chip Carter, thanked her for helping him through addiction and crisis in his own personal life, thanked his parents for putting such a good example of how to treat other people and treat each other and be in love. And that example, longest presidential marriage in history, 77 years. Amy Carter, you know, read a letter of what it was like to be apart from each other and how much they loved each other and how much her father just needed her mother in his life, his wife, Rosalynn Carter. And then Jason coming in and really, really teaching, you know, the story about them flying on a Delta flight, which I can't imagine. I mean, of course, Delta is the number one airline out of one of the biggest or the biggest airport in the country, Atlanta. But to imagine the whole Carter family taking up the back of a commercial flight to go on vacation somewhere. And then he talked about as soon as the flight was up in the air and they could, Rosalynn Carter pulled out of her carry-on luggage a Tupperware thing full of pimento cheese and started making pimento cheese sandwiches and handing them out. And she had so much, she started handing them out to people on the plane. And Jason Carter saying, like, what were these people thinking as this old lady, his grandmother, former first lady, Rosalynn Carter, is walking up and down the aisles handing out pimento cheese sandwiches. It's just fantastic. You can't. Another wonderful story that I want to tell just while it's on my mind before I forget. This comes from Leanne Smith, and her father was Rosalynn Carter's brother. So she is a niece. At Thanksgiving, I forget the year, but in the mid-70s, a Thanksgiving dinner, then Governor Jimmy Carter stood up at the table after grace and before people got kind of started dug in. He says, I have an announcement I want to make to the family. I'm running for president. And Leanne's father said, of what? And everyone got a big laugh. And he said, of the United States, you know, and he's just like, what? I mean, it's just, it's so, there's such real people. They're such real people with in a down-to-earth way, in a wonderful, to think that Rosalynn's brother could tease his brother-in-law so much when he says, I'm running for president of what? Like, because the president of the United States was so big and so outside of planes, but he'd already conquered the state of Georgia and become governor. Why wouldn't he run for president of the United States? But just that story just endears them to me even more and shows what I try to show through all of my writing, all of my speeches, all of my research, the C-SPAN, White House Historical Association, everything. These are real people. They win, they lose, they live. We see now all too well, they die. You know, they bleed They cry, they laugh, they have families, they celebrate holidays, they go on planes, they go on vacation, they eat pimento cheese sandwiches, but also, like Jason taught us, they climb mountains. Mrs. Carter went to every mountaintop except, like, well, it was Everest and Fuji, and I think the one she missed was Kilimanjaro. I don't know. It's just incredible first lady and just incredible human being. Take first lady out of it. She did things that most human beings did. And she did it at a time when most folks are retiring. And she just kept going. And these are the things we learned. And this is, it goes back to my mom telling me, funerals are celebrations of life. And they are an opportunity to learn even things about someone you thought you knew everything about. And that's what the First Lady's television series is about, the C-SPAN White House Historical Television Series. That's what my speeches are about. That's what my books are about. But these women went on to do things, Martha Washington, all the way through Dr. Jill Biden and whoever's next. And whenever we have a first gentleman in there, they are doing work to change and make the modern world a better place. And there is no better example of that than Rosalynn Carter and the work that she did as First Lady of Georgia, as First Lady of the United States, and as a retired First Lady, all the way up to and including into her 90s, and her work will long live past her time here on Earth.
Oh, Andrew, what a great way to wrap this up. Thank you so much for sharing this story with me. I think you've made some really personal connections today, and I just really appreciate you sharing those with our audience. And I hope everybody will go and check out the resources that you've shared. Firstladiesman.com. What a name. I love that so much. What are you going to do when there's a first gentleman?
I'll always be the first ladies man. But I look forward to my coverage, my research, and what the first gentleman would do.
Andrew, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate you. And thank you for telling these women's stories.
Well, thank you. I can't be the first ladies man without folks like you and podcasts and websites and social media groups. So you're doing the work as well. It takes a village, and we're all part of that village together. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for listening to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts to bring more voices to the conversation. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.